live.
Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., Baby K from the Sweet Spot teams up with DJ Spinna in a tribute to the mighty force of musical ascension known as Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll be featuring an interview we did with bassist Verdine White and also chopping it up with Spinna as he plays some of his favorite Earth, Wind, and Fire tracks. That's The Sweet Spot, Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale. On Tuesday, June 20th, my guest on EcoLogic will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller, who will predict this summer's weather and hurricane season and explain how El Niños and La Niñas in the Western Pacific Ocean and storms in the Western Sahara Desert will affect our weather. That's Tuesday, June 20th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, was written as a warning. Today, it's used as a playbook.
Do you believe in God, Winston? No. Then what is it, this principle that will defeat us? I don't know. The spirit of man? And do you consider yourself a man? Yes. If you are a man, Winston, you are the last man.
Tune in Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour Pacifica National broadcast of our classic 1975 cover-to-cover marathon reading of 1984 on your Pacifica station. That's Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour marathon broadcast.
Hi, everybody. James Irsay here. This is your invitation to join me Friday mornings from 10 a.m. to noon for Morning Irsay. We listen to great historical performances of mainly, but not exclusively, classical music, with an emphasis on early scratchy piano recordings. And we also talk about them a lot. No need to dress up or even wash your face. Just sit around your home or office and enjoy 2 hours of diverting distraction as we broadcast great, hardly ever or even never heard performances of Golden Age musicians. Morning Irsay, Fridays 10 to noon on 99.5 WBAI and WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin. You're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In this week's program, we're going to be, in the first half, taking a look at the ACT UP movement, history of it, and some parts that haven't been paid too much attention to in recent years with some of the major films and literature that's come out on it. So stay tuned for that. And Catherine Davis will be here in the second half of the program. But first, we'll start with the Health Action news for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. Location, location, location. That mantra may apply even when it comes to how opioid addiction is treated. Specifically, patients with private insurance who are diagnosed with opioid dependency or abuse may get different medical services depending on where they live, according to a white paper by a national database that's released this week. Medical responses to opioid-related diagnoses appear to differ among the five states examined by Fair Health, a nonprofit that provides cost information to the health industry and consumers. To draw that conclusion, researchers analyzed the health insurance billing codes associated with those diagnoses. The new report shows the five most common, as well as the five most expensive, procedures related to opioid abuse or dependency diagnoses that insurers paid for in 2016 in five states: California, New York, Illinois, Texas, and Pennsylvania. They were chosen because they include the country's five most populous cities. In California, for example, patients most commonly received outpatient services such as counseling and also drug tests, which can include screening for narcotic use. Illinois' top two services were 15-minute doctor office visits and injections of naltrexone, a drug used to prevent relapse in patients who were dependent on opioids. By contrast, methadone, an opioid medication used to reduce withdrawal symptoms for patients trying to quit narcotics, was New York's most common medical billed to an opioid-related diagnosis. All five of the most common procedures listed on the bills in Texas were drug screening tests, some of which were the same test codes as those on the California list. But the Lone Star State also included a few that were not, including urinalysis, which checks for improper drug use. Why those differences exist is harder to tease out based on the data from Fair Health, which examines claims-blind data from insurers representing more than 150 million Americans who have job-based insurance or buy it on their own. The data do not include claims from government programs such as Medicare or Medicaid. The variation among the states may reflect general attitudes, access to the health system, and systems most readily available in those states, said Robin Gelbert, president of Fair Health. Surprisingly, the study found that the largest percentage of medical coverage claims related to opioid abuse and dependence diagnoses nationally come from older patients, those aged 51 to 60. This patient group accounted for 32% of the services billed in rural areas and 25% in urban areas from 2007 to 2016. By contrast, younger 19 to 22-year-olds with those same diagnoses accounted for only 10% of billed services in urban areas and just 2% in rural areas. Older patients can run into dependence problems when they get long-term opioid treatment for chronic pain. With younger patients, doctors are less likely to continue to prescribe opioids, leading some young people to turn to street drugs instead, such as heroin. Two female Senate Republicans could stop the anti-abortion movement from achieving its most significant win against Planned Parenthood in decades. Most Republicans in Congress want to eliminate their group's $555 million annual funding as part of their bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act. However, as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tries to solve the legislative Rubik's Cube of finding 50 votes for it, he may have to drop the Planned Parenthood cut to win support of two Republican moderates, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. The problem is, McConnell would then face the wrath of anti-abortion communities and its supporters within the Senate. Several prominent anti-abortion groups warned last week in a letter to the Senate that they would oppose a bill that doesn't cut off funding to Planned Parenthood and prohibit insurance subsidies from covering abortion services. The debate over using the repeal bill to eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood is one of a half a dozen issues that have threatened to divide the Republican conference and prevent them from achieving their long-term goal of repealing the health care law. However, how many Republicans may be willing to stake their vote for repeal on the bill's inclusion of Planned Parenthood cuts is unclear. Last year, Planned Parenthood got $550 million in government funding. The organization has said the majority of that money is reimbursements for health services provided under Medicaid, which prohibits abortion funding except in the cases of rape, incest, and the mother's health. Republicans say their new bill would take the federal funding that now goes to Planned Parenthood and divert it to community health centers, which they say are more accessible to certain groups, for instance, people in rural areas. Planned Parenthood argues that most community health centers don't provide the women's health services that they do, and that Medicaid recipients should be able to choose the best health care provider for them. Planned Parenthood and Democrats say they would do everything they could to make defunding and repeal of the Affordable Care Act overall huge political issues in next year's 2018 midterm elections, forcing Republicans to defend their decision to take health care away from vulnerable populations. However, anti-abortion groups, which are influential with many conservative politicians, say the issue of banning the funding is just as important for them. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment, taking a look at the history of the ACT UP movement. Stay tuned. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment for this week's program, we're going to be taking a look back at the history of ACT UP. The organization is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. And unlike many activist organizations, it's still going strong. We have guests today. First is Bob Letterer, an organizer with ACT UP New York and the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power from 1988 to 2000. He was co-founder of the organization's Alternative and Holistic Treatment Committee and helped organize campaigns to transform AIDS research, fund needle exchange programs, and expand treatment access to the global south. He's also a longtime print journalist and the co-host of this program, Health Action, as well as a contributing producer to WBAI's Out FM program, which airs Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Welcome, Bob. It's good to sort of be, have you on the other side of the table, as it were.
Thank you so much
for
having me.
Your second guest is Linda Meredith, who joined ACT UP in 1988, participating in protests with ACT UP New York during the Democratic National Convention, and founding ACT UP Atlanta shortly thereafter. For 30 years, she has pressed for equality in research and treatment for women with HIV in ACT UP DC and from 1992 to 1995 as a member of ACT UP New York. For the past year and a half, she's lived in Atlanta. Welcome to Health Action, Linda.
Thanks so much for having me.
And last but not least, here in studio, joining me is Alfredo Gonzalez, who's an HIV activist and medical anthropologist. In 1990, he joined the Latino Caucus of ACT UP New York, and that experience has informed his political and community work since. As an anthropologist, he's done research in New York City, Santo Domingo, and Rio de Janeiro. Welcome to Health Action, Alfredo.
Hello, everybody.
It's good to see and talk to everybody again. It's been a while. And in full disclosure, I should say that I was very active in ACT UP for about a decade or so, starting in the early 90s, working on issues of healthcare access and health insurance, and have become reactivated in the organization since the election last fall. It is interesting that the organization's membership has increased since then, so it's a phenomenon that's happening widely. So the main reason we wanted to talk to all three of you today is about a conference that's coming up this coming weekend, Sunday, July 18th, at the LGBT Community Center here in Manhattan at 208 West 13th Street. The conference is titled ACT UP New York, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. Bob, you're one of the main drivers behind organizing this. What's the stimulus, the rationale for this, other than the fact that it's the 30th anniversary?
The writing of history is a crucial piece for any movement, any political movement for change. And when we now have this 30 years of experience behind us, it's a really good time to kind of look back at the accomplishments and to note the what's become ACT UP. ACT UP is an iconic organization, and so there have actually been several books, several movies, and dozens of articles written. And when you look carefully at those, you see a pattern of omissions and distortions that don't allow some of the real stories of what ACT UP accomplished, and very importantly, who played a role in the accomplishment. A lot of the narratives emphasize white middle-class men, and to a lesser extent, a handful of women who mainly focus on treatment issues, which are extremely important. But yet all of this other tremendous life-saving work that ACT UP has done for the past 30 years, both on the local, the national, and the global level, and together with a range of other groups in coalition, locally and nationally and globally, tends to get ignored or in some cases just completely left out. And those are very crucial stories for folks to hear about, not only in their own right, but for the lessons that they can teach that other movements may find benefit in learning what strategies win, because ACT UP has a phenomenal track record of success, and that's some of what we want to impart this Sunday.
And also spawned a lot of organizations that are now on their own, kind of carrying forth different pieces of the activist tradition from back then. I remember when I first got involved, this was before we had the days of the internet and everything was still on paper. There were some 30, 40 committees that were working on all kinds of different aspects of what was termed the AIDS and still is termed the AIDS crisis. And yes, treatment activism was certainly a big piece of it, but by no means the only focus. Linda, let me turn to you. What was your impetus for getting involved in the AIDS activist movement?
So I was living in Atlanta in 1988, and I put my name on a list for housing folks from ACT UP New York who were coming down to do protest actions at the Democratic National Convention. And I ended up having a weekend sleepover with Maxine Wolf, Maria Magenti, and Maxine's daughter, Amy. So, you know, if you can't get politicized from spending a weekend with those folks, right?
Yes.
In any case, after my participation in many of the ACT UP events of that Democratic Convention week, I was hooked, and I ended up founding ACT UP New York, ACT UP Atlanta shortly thereafter, and my career of activism in support of women with HIV continued to D.C. and then to New York.
Yeah, and just for listeners' benefit, Maxine is considered one of the founding mothers of the lesbian feminist movement here in New York City. So just to identify kind of who she is. So at some point or other, you ended up here in New York becoming active here. So how did that come about?
Well, I had always wanted to live in New York, but starting from Georgia, it took me a few minutes to try to creep my way up the East Coast. Once I was doing work in collaboration with the Women's Caucus of ACT UP New York while living in D.C., I finally found a way and sort of the courage just to move right on into the thick of things in New York and immerse myself in ACT UP New York.
And Alfredo, how did you get involved in the work of ACT UP and the activist movement?
Well, I entered ACT UP through the Latino Caucus. I came into ACT UP to work with the Latino Caucus, and eventually founded with the members the committee, ACT UP Americas. The difference between the Caucus and ACT UP Americas was important. The Caucus was a group close to non-Latinos. That is a very difficult thing to determine who is Latino and who's not, mm-hmm. but that was the idea. There was a space in which Latinos could express their concerns and political interest without having somebody looking over their shoulders or being afraid of making a mistake. As a group, we looked because of the nature of what it means to be Latino, our take on the epidemic didn't end within the borders of the United States. So we began to think of the epidemic as a transnational phenomenon way before other people within ACT UP began to think about the global implications of ACT UP. And of course, our center was, our interest, our focus was Latin America. And so we created relationships with people in Latin America. We sent medications to Latin America. We had actual impact, real impact in Latin America in a number of issues.
Great. Okay, so we've got some of the basics down, everybody's personal story. Well, maybe, Bob, I should ask you, how did you get involved in the ACT UP movement?
Well, I had been involved in the what at that time was referred to as the lesbian and gay left, before the bisexuals and transgender folks, you know, asserted their rights to be part of that constellation. When ACT UP came along, I knew how vicious and horrendous and genocidal the epidemic had become, although it had not touched me personally, other than through one friend who was sick. But the urgency and the anger was so moving and so compelling that I had to be a part of this, as my community was standing up and fighting back. And it tied into my previous political work, not only in the queer movement, but also in the anti-imperialist and anti-racist movement, that this was a fundamental exposure of the inhumane nature of the system of capitalism and imperialism that we live under, and that this was a battle that had to be fought and had to be supported across different racial and gender and sexuality lines and class lines, for some of the people who were facing the worst treatment that a society could dole out.
So, Linda, you were active in the Women's Caucus. Can you tell us what I mentioned in the introduction about issues of treatment for women, but what was sort of the constellation of issues that the Women's Caucus sort of brought to the fore within the ACT UP movement?
Right. So I was thinking about this in preparation for this weekend's events and trying to put some bow around everything that happened back in the late 80s and early 1990s in terms of activism and civil disobedience and well-informed facts about the needs of HIV-positive women. So the majority of our work focused on three government agencies with interconnecting reasons for those focus, but yet different. So a lot of people have heard, I think, about the CDC campaign that we started, that was a four-year campaign for the CDC definition to be changed to include the opportunistic infections that women were getting and dying from without ever being counted, acknowledged, or receiving disability benefits. So that was kind of number one. So the CDC and the Social Security Administration, who followed their definition, was in a little package. We also pushed against the NIH, specifically the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who were conducting the majority of the clinical trials toward treatment research at that time, but yet did not include women in that research, did not study treatments for the opportunistic infections that women were getting, and at that time, many of the clinical trials from the ACTG were the pivotal studies that resulted in the early treatments being approved for, you know, general use. And then the last component of the government inaction had to do with the FDA, and our work there centered on making it a requirement that pharmaceutical companies applying for drug approval have sufficient numbers of women in their clinical trials to be able to analyze if there were differences in either efficacy or safety for the women that were going to take this medicine once it was approved and on the market.
And so that's one campaign. What were some of the other major campaigns that the
women... Actually, no, that's three campaigns
one. Three campaigns
in
one, sorry.
I know that a lot of attention has been paid to changing the CDC definition, but our work at the NIH and our work at the FDA were other aspects of how the system was failing HIV-positive women and were, in some cases, simultaneously going on while that CDC campaign was going on as well.
Alfredo, did the Latino community face similar kinds of challenges that Linda was describing?
Well, the Latino community were not discriminated in the same way that women were from clinical trials. The challenges of the Latino community were back home in our communities, in understanding that our community was at risk, understanding that we needed to get together around these issues, and we needed to stand up and take strong positions. That was a challenge and something that the Latino Cocos did in terms of HIV. We had other campaigns, but nothing comparable to what was just described about women.
Oh, well, can you give us an example? What were a few of
them? Well, we had, for example, well, we initiated a series of actions in San Juan, Puerto Rico, that resulted in the creation of ACT UP San Juan. We also created a campaign in support of the CHAD, the Comunidad Homosexual Argentina, which was the homosexual community, the Argentine community, mm-hmm. Which was the only gay organization in Argentina and had been denied the legal personality several times. So we organized a demo in front of the New York City Consulate of Argentina, and eventually were able to challenge the president of Argentina that same year in November here at Columbia University and force him to speak publicly about the situation, in which he suddenly revealed that the issue had been resolved and that Cha had legal personality. It was a surprise for everyone. But it was a success because that organization remained the only gay organization with legal personality for the following 25 years.
Interesting. Bob, let's talk about this conference itself. Describe sort of the general format of the program. What topics are going to be sort of discussed in what order? What's the rationale, et cetera?
Sure. Okay. So it's a day-long conference from 10:30 to 6:30 this Sunday, the 18th, and we start with some opening kind of overview presentations, and then we move to the first panel on campaigns supporting particular HIV-threatened communities in New York and the country, and that includes one on people of color, Latinas and Latinos, and also Latin Americans, as Alfredo was just describing, drug users and harm reduction efforts, and I just want to highlight that that is one of the tremendous success stories of ACT UP and its allies in legalizing needle exchange in New York State, which is a tremendous life-saving program, and also in just providing the people power that started, along with many others, several of the needle exchange and broader harm reduction programs to reduce the harm of drug use throughout New York City. Then a panel on youth campaigns, safer sex in schools, and many other things, a panel on women. Then the second major section of the day is about access to treatment and care, survival benefits, criminalization, and new research directions. And there's a lot of important work that was done in all those areas. The one I just want to highlight here is on global treatment that I was very privileged to be one of the co-founders of a national coalition called Health Gap Global Access Project that working with a lot of other partners in around the U.S. and particularly in South Africa and some other countries, developed a combination tactic campaign that within 3 years of starting it in 1999 had fundamentally changed U.S. government policy towards providing aid to poor countries needing HIV treatment. And today there are 17 million people worldwide with HIV who are on treatment who weren't on it 25 years ago. So that's a really important one to highlight. And then also another great victory, which we're going to talk about, is the whole creation of a major social service agency called Housing Works, which grew out of the Housing Committee of ACT UP that serves dozens of people with housing, with supportive services, and has a lot of input from the HIV community in running that program. And finally, prison issues, camp that was maintained in Guantanamo for HIV-positive Haitians long before 9/11, a real outrage. It was a brutal quarantine system that ACT UP and many allies successfully shut down in 1993. So that's basically what we're going to cover. And then in a separate room down the hall, we're going to have two simultaneous trainings, one about direct, nonviolent direct action, what are the techniques that ACT UP has used so well in many other movements, and the second is on social media and how to get your message out effectively. So it's a packed day with lots of material to learn, and we're including time for audience participation.
Now, of course, this conference is not just looking back, but also has a focus on a sort of lessons learned for today and where we're sort of at and what's happening now in the AIDS activist movement. Linda, a couple minutes from you on where are things now from the perspective of women activists?
So I left ACT UP New York in 1995, but Terry Wilder, who is a member of ACT UP New York and works at the Spencer Cox Health Center in New York, is going to give a presentation on women and treatment in the years post-2000. From the point of view of the three different governmental campaigns that I referred to earlier, there is now research being, well, of course, the CDC changed their definition of HIV. There is now research being done within the NIH that includes women in the clinical trials, but still the FDA remains an uncracked nut, if you will. While they have required that pharmaceutical sponsors report the numbers of women versus men in clinical trials, they have yet to require that the numbers of women be large enough so as to allow for a real statistical analysis. And so that work was never finished, but we made some progress in that area.
We'll hear about that at the more about that at the conference. And Alfredo, the Latino Caucus and the ACT UP America's chapter committee, how has that work continued into the present?
Well, it has continued in many different ways. More importantly, through the commitment that each of us as individuals acquired at that time in terms of fighting the HIV epidemic in a new conceptual geography that united New York with the rest of the continent. Personally, I've been part of, I've been actually the vice president of the Association of Latin American Association of People with HIV, huh? Which was something that the Pan American Health Organization sponsored, huh? Until UNAIDS was created and the configuration changed. I've been involved with supporting the HIV the Cuban HIV program, and I remain very attent and ready to get together in different formations with people that I met then that I know have the same community that we actually took from ACT UP and the idea, the concept of politics that ACT UP brought forward.
Great. Well, we've been getting a little bit of a preview here on this interview segment of the program today, taking a look at what's coming up this coming weekend on Sunday, June 18th, a special conference called 30 Years of ACT UP New York, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. It's being held at the LGBT Center in Manhattan. The address is 208 West 13th Street between 7th and 8th Avenue. The space is wheelchair accessible. You can register for the conference. It's free. So please come. I'm going to be one of the panelists there talking about healthcare access issues and universal health, the fight for universal healthcare here in the U.S., which is still ongoing, I must say. You can register for the conference at www.actupny.com. Again, www.actupny.com. Or for more information, you can call 212-966-4873. Again, 212-966-4873. And registrations are strongly urged so that they can make sure there's enough seating space and enough food for everybody. So please go to the website and register if you plan to attend. Our guests for this segment have been Bob Letter, who was an organizer with ACT UP New York and is co-host of this program with myself and Catherine Davis, Alfredo Gonzalez, who's an HIV activist and medical anthropologist, and Linda Meredith, who has been a women's health activist in the AIDS activist movement. Thanks so much, Bob, Alfredo, and Linda, for joining us here on Health Action.
Nice hanging out with you, Mark.
Thank you.
Great. And we'll be Catherine Davis will be here next with the rest of the program. Stay tuned. I'm Mark Hannay. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this segment.
Good morning. You're listening to Health Action over WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis. I want to begin to think about vision from the perspective of our expanded self. Vision is really something that is a contender to our thinking processes. We can, in many ways, drown ourselves in thoughts and lose sight of that inspiration that comes through our vision. And in this regard, of course, I'm speaking of inner vision. I'm speaking in terms of going into our innate capacity to see and feel and intuit our lives, our behaviors, our interactions. And when we get into that inner visioning, it allows us to be self-inspired. And I'm going to tell you about what happened with me some years ago, actually, now. And I have been a person who does meditation for many, many years. And I started out really not being a good meditator. I started out not being able to be quiet for more than 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 5 minutes at the best. And I was just persistent. I was persistent, and I would just put my energy there and go into a space where I could be quiet. And the greatest challenge, of course, for me, I guess for many, in going into the practice of meditation is contending with our thoughts. And for a number of years, I really did struggle with how to get above, below, to the side of all the thought processes that were in my mind. And after a time, you begin to get a sense of release when you're going into meditation, because as you have more experience, your thoughts begin to fade, they have less impact. And that's really one of the best benefits of meditation. But after some years, I would say even a good 20 years of being a meditator, I began to move into a different phase. And I feel this was more impacted by the energies of our collective, the general progression of collective evolution, spiritual evolution. And it was really in the vicinity of that shift that many people talk about back in 2012, when I began to experience just a spontaneous deepening in this process of meditation. And I began to go into what I would call communion with the spiritual realm. So I began to accept that, yes, indeed, my world, my life, my experience is not limited to the physical realm in which we live. So I began to engage in a conscious conversation with what I presumed at that time to be my higher self. Of course, yes, in fact, we do have this communication with the greater self. But at that time, it was a one-way conversation. There wasn't feedback. And so I would do things like go into my dream space with a question. So I might be dealing with a particular relationship or a particular workplace situation or maybe something going on with my family. And rather than moving into worrying about whatever that experience was happening, I would go into my dream space with a bit of a prayer, I guess you would say, a request, not for a solving of the problem, but for to receive through that dream space some understanding, some reconciliation, a way to understand how I could be the active problem solver in my everyday life. So I wasn't really looking for a miracle. I was looking for inspiration. And once I started doing that practice, I began to realize that I was indeed waking up with solutions to whatever it was that I was concerned about. And so I had this very real experience that something was going on in that dream time space. And this is how I really began to expand in my conscious awareness through this actual personal experience. I would recommend that if you're not doing that, you do go ahead and try that, because what happens is that you begin just through the intention of putting forth the question into that going into sleep, then your sleep, when you wake up, will return and you'll wake up with some inspiration, some conscious awareness of what you can do to resolve these issues. And so as I did this more, it became a more powerful process. And then one of the other things that I added to that was the affirmation process. Because the other part of, in meditation, having these thoughts that seemed to be interrupting my peaceful space, I began to listen to those thoughts and recognize that these were repetitive patterns. They were, in some ways, programming that had been implanted into my mind. You know, you pick them up all through your life from your parents, from the TV, from the society around us. We get impressions of who we are and how we are supposed to be in the world. And what the mind does is it sets up these patterns and it almost torments you or taunts you, repeats it in order to take your attention and make sure that you're really doing whatever this patterning requires. So the patterning could be healthy. It could say, you're a beautiful woman and, you know, I love myself. Or you're a smart guy and you can make it through the day, but more often the patterns are things that plague us, like, oh, nobody listens to me, oh, I don't have any power, or it might be you're bad. When you do this behavior, you're bad. If you eat too much food, you're bad. If you're not nice to people, you're bad. And we get into these patterns of behavior that are controlled by these repetitive thoughts. And so I came to this realization once I started actually listening more with an ear of just keeping track of the thoughts that were running through my mind. And then I added to that some inspiration in the morning and some affirmations in the mornings so that I would wake up and whatever mood I woke up in, whatever thoughts were racing through my mind, I would pattern my affirmation to challenge that repetitive thought. So if I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking, oh, I'm tired, that was always a big one for me and still is a challenge, actually. I'm tired. And so after a while, I began to realize that there was a space in which I was saying to myself, I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired, that was actually affecting my physiology, causing me to be tired. And so what I would do waking up is begin to listen in for the pattern that was in play that day and craft an affirmation that would challenge it. So it would be, I'm energetic, I'm waking full of energy and have abundance of energy. I can get all that I want to get done today. And so after a few moments of the repetitive affirmation, it would, in that moment, dissolve the negative pattern and my body would respond with more energy. And so this really began to give me an understanding, an actual understanding of how powerful the messages are to our physiology. The messages in our mind are very powerful in controlling how we feel about things and also how our body will react energetically as we move through our day. So I found that as I was going forward, that I was crafting these tools to work with the repetitive patterns in my mind. The first tool is to go to sleep with an intent. So to bring the request for the resolution of a issue, a problem, a challenge in life. And then I would wake up with that, with some insight for that. And then the second layer was to use these affirmations to challenge whatever repetitive patterns in thinking were getting in my way. And so this, as I moved along doing this, and I did this for a number of years, I began to move more smoothly into the dream space. And I began to experience the dream or the interaction that was providing me with the inspiration that I woke up with. And so as I began to have these dreams, I added to my process a dream book. And so sometimes when you first wake up, just before the day kicks in, you'll remember the dream. So I would write down my dreams and my insights, because within a few minutes, generally speaking, they would vanish. And so I began to craft all of these mechanisms for getting in touch more directly with the inner vision, the guiding force, the higher self that can help us to make our way through the day. And, you know, this was all very helpful, and it was expanding my understanding and capacity for the nature of our inner self, the inner life, the invisible self, really. The fact that we don't see that expanded self, or maybe not hear directly, or have that direct connection, it's really important to understand that we have that guiding, loving force that is doing its best to steer our path in ways that would be beneficial. So what happened is I started having these dreams in which I was lucid and I would remember certain experiences of maybe speaking to guides that I interact with as a more expanded being, or there were experiences where I was maybe traveling and flowing, witnessing into other life streams. So I might have a dream where I was in another time of Earth, another time. But the interesting thing is that the dream, once I started writing it down, I began to realize that these dreams were also connected to the issues I were having in the day. So within the dream, I might find either the source of my challenge, the source of whatever was bothering me, whatever insecurity I might have had. And so then I began to use that dream space information in my writing, in my affirmations. So it became a much more expansive cognitive reality that I was opening up within my life. And, you know, during this process, I reached a point where I had one really defining experience that really helped to clarify for me that thoughts are definitively not ours. They're not real, and they're not really of our own wisdom. They are more of the world. And when you think about it, the mind is a mechanism that is designed to deal with our outer world. It's designed to keep us safe in the world, to negotiate, to, you know, to make sure that we have the income that we need and the relationships that we need. And so the mind is a very, very potent and important part of ourself. But the mind itself is not the source of inspiration, is not the source of the aha, of the idea, of the creativity. The mind is more of a translator tool that helps to integrate into the world. And what happens very often, because our world is so controlling of us, that we become mechanized through the mind. We become self-enslaved in a way through our own thoughts. And this happens, as I said, through education systems, through the value systems in our society, to the family. But from my perspective, all of that can be circumvented or turned off by moving into that deeper connection to the source self, the entity, the being of you that is enlivening your body, that is bringing the life force, that is breathing through the body so that you can have this experience. There's a part of us that we're missing because our society doesn't teach us about it. It isn't that it wasn't always accessible. It's just that we're programmed in a different way. But at any rate, I was in one of these dream states, and in that state, I was more disembodied and felt myself actually more potently. I was there with my spiritual guide, my higher self guide, and we were engaged in a conversation, this counsel, I would say. I was receiving the counsel of my higher self with regard to movement on the ground, how I could interact in the world with more success and with less torment. You know, at the time I was going through some emotional issues with family and stuff. So I was in this beautiful conversation, and I became more conscious of that. So I was conscious of having this conversation, and then I was conscious of listening to the conversation and speaking these words and hearing these words of the higher self counsel. And then in the background, I began to hear thoughts very softly, and they were the thoughts of my worries. And so they were just, it was almost like a ticker tape screen, only it was audio, running across the bottom of my consciousness, very, very soft. of these words that was saying, oh, I'm in trouble. Oh, this one is in trouble. Oh, I'm so tired. Oh, I'm so depressed. Oh, I'm so unhappy. So there was this, you know, faint voice of all these troubles running in the background. And then as I'm engaging in the conversation with my higher self, that noise starts to get a little bit louder. And then I could feel myself being distracted into that dialogue. And the last moment of awareness I had of being in the presence of my higher self, I was saying, I'm losing, I'm getting lost in the thoughts. I'm getting lost in the thoughts. And what happened is that gradually these thinking patterns, you know, became a cacophony in my ability to connect and communicate with the higher self diminished in equal proportion. But as that was happening, I still maintained this sort of third awareness of witnessing the whole thing that I was able to hold on to. And what I began to realize that while I was in the dream space, disengaged from my body, that these thoughts were just running through the mind, and it was just a matter of them taking my attention. And so as I my awareness became aware of these worrisome thoughts, I had a very clear, distinct understanding that I was not these thoughts, and these thoughts really were not representative of myself. And that, for me, was a real empowering moment, because it was real clear to me that whatever was going on in a destructive way in my own mind was something that was implanted, was something that I picked up, was something that was learned, but it had really nothing to do with who I am as a being. And so that gave me so much more capacity to look at thoughts and recognize it for what it is, to disengage emotionally from those thoughts, and to not give it energy, because that's the real key. The reason thoughts tap into our emotions is because the energy of our emotions ends up in a loop with the thoughts, just feeding the repetitive pattern. So when we can recognize these thoughts as just a learned behavior, repetitive pattern, whatever the thoughts are, we can keep our emotional responses withdrawn from those thoughts. So if we're thinking about something our best friend said last week, we can think about it and get angry over and over and over again, because we're tapping into it with the emotions. But if we can recognize it, oh, this is a repetitive pattern. It's not about anything that my friend did last week. It's about this being a repetitive pattern. So let me not invest in that pattern. So you can look at it, but not put your emotions into it. And the more adept you are at withdrawing your emotions from the pattern, the more quickly those mental patterns will disappear, and the more efficiently you can bring the voice of your inner vision, your higher self, your guides, into your everyday awareness. So there's a way in which, rather than walking with the thoughts that have been implanted through societal means, you walk with the wisdom of your own divinity. And so that gives you the empowerment to have an almost immediate connection to your divine presence and the fullness of who you truly are. So I just wanted to share that with you. And we are coming to the end of this program. You've been listening to Health Action over WBAI in New York. I'm Catherine Davis. Please connect through my email, heartofmindradio@gmail.com, and tune in on Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. for the radio program Heart of Mind, hosted by myself, Catherine Davis. And tune in again next week for Health Action, Wednesday into Thursday mornings at midnight.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. This morning, our guest on recording from the past and from the more recent past is Andy Duncan. Stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The new Korean animated zombie horror film, Seoul Station, presents a curious challenge, for me at least. For some reason, this is the year that I've been confronted with several films that raise the question of whether they really need to be animated or could have done just as well as live-action films. I've found a number of reasons to come to the defense of the animated format, from the way Tower, a reenactment of the Texas Clock Tower shootings, used animation to convey the subjective experience of the people who survived the attack, to how My Life as a Zucchini employed the whimsical design of its stop-motion puppets to finesse some melodramatic bumps in its tale of abused children in a foster home. But Seoul Station, which captures the initial moments of a zombie outbreak as seen through the eyes of, among others, a runaway prostitute, her shiftless boyfriend, and a number of homeless taking shelter in the titular train station, is a prequel to another and very good film, Train to Busan, which follows a group of passengers on a speeding bullet train as they experience roughly the same timeline. And that film is live action. And under the circumstance, a number of the easier arguments in favor of animation break down. Seoul Station has a number of ambitious sequences with hordes of ravenous zombies and the response of a militarized police that echoes South Korea's less than exemplary history of confronting organized protest. But Train to Busan has that too, including such indelible images as a wave of zombies throwing themselves lemming-like onto the moving train from an overpass and a growing fan of clawing undead being dragged by an engine. Seoul Station is a bit more ambitious in scope. I'm thinking that one budgetary advantage they had on Train was containing a lot of action to a railroad car set that could just be redressed, but that's more by degree. In the moment of watching, both films do not stint, so I'm really at a loss to give a rigorous defense to the use of animation here. What Seoul Station does do is bring to the fore some social commentary that is only briefly touched upon in Train to Busan. The plight of the homeless figures prominently, and the film shows considerable insight in taking in the mix of addiction, mental illness, and just plain misfortune that runs through that society, while the armed response raises damning questions about what happens when a government begins treating its own citizens as the enemy. Seoul Station, and by the way, that's spelled S-E-O-U-L, like the city, I'm not sure if the pun is intentional or not, but Seoul Station takes the action-filled approach to zombie outbreak explored in Train to Busan, and introduces the social relevance that since Night of the Living Dead has become the hallmark of zombie films. Animated or not, it is an impressive addition to the genre. It may be me, but it strikes me that Korean dramas have no reluctance to indulging in near-operatic expressions of emotion. Men under duress will break down and cry just as easily as women, if not more so. One notable moment in Seoul Station has the prostitute breaking into tears and sobbing that she just wants to go home to her father, and the homeless man accompanying her promptly erupting into histrionics himself. Compare that to a moment early in the Japanese drama Tatara Samurai, in which the protagonist, a metalsmith named Gosuke, played by Shun Sagata, sees his friend murdered by bandits and, clutching the man's body, cries out his name as other villagers drop to their knees and bow their heads. No shortage of emotion, really, just a bit less baroque in its expression. Above and beyond that, Tatara Samurai is a beautiful and gripping tale of a man torn between serving his village as the master of its forge and taking up the sword of the samurai. That the story is set in a time when the balance of warfare is being shifted by the introduction of a fearsome new weapon, the rifle, gives Tatara Samurai a dark complexity that sets it apart from simple samurai action. No fantasy stuff in this, no wire stunts, though there are some good fight sequences, but it's the engaging drama in a man's awakening from the daydream of heroism that makes Tatara Samurai worthwhile. The more fanciful stuff can be saved for another day. And just a quick note, I haven't read any reviews and I've been trying to avoid the comments on Facebook, but it appears I'm enjoying American Gods more than I should be. Right now, my biggest complaint is that with the season finale coming next week, I'm feeling that the season hasn't been structured in a way that could make whatever's in store in this last episode feel like anything but an anticlimax. Otherwise, I pretty much love what Brian Fuller and company have done. It's vividly surreal, quirky, yet with Fuller's empathy for both the gods and the humans. To those who feel otherwise, I humbly apologize. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And one should always have one's hashtags with eggs, is how I recommend it. Once over easy. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and vibrating over WBAI.org. Now, actually, we vibrate over the air, and I'm not sure what it is that we do online to get there. Maybe we vibrate there as well. But at any rate, good morning. We have a jam-packed show this morning because we have two pieces of recording with the brilliant, wonderful teacher and science fiction writer Andy Duncan. And part of it is that I have a recording of a novella that he read on this program about the turn of the century, I think, you know, about 2001 or so. And it's a brilliant short story entitled Zora and the Zombie. And then we have an interview that I recorded with him just shy of a month ago during the Nebula Awards conference. And I have been debating which would come first, the chicken or the egg. And talking with Matt here, we decided the egg. That is to say, we're going to start with the short story, and then we will go to the interview. So hang out for both. If you don't know who she is, Zora Neale Hurston is one of the great figures in American history, specifically of the Harlem Renaissance. She wrote in a genre of her own. But she didn't write this story. Andy Duncan did. But it is about her. It's curiously, being about her and a zombie, I note that Terrence Taylor, an often guest of ours, has her as an important character in his Vampire Testament trilogy. So I think it's really cool that she has found her way into science fiction and fantasy circles in more than one story. But Andy Duncan's story most definitely merits your attention and consideration, and then stay tuned for a recent interview with him.